You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My mic's down really low and I can't seem to move it up, so I'm just going to have to crouch here behind the panel today. It is Wednesday.
Wednesday.
I know it's Wednesday. It's the 7th of May today.
7th of May. Yes, that's right.
We made it to May.
We made it.
Yeah.
To the 5th month of 2025.
Time just goes by so quick.
Indeed. What have we got lined up on the show today?
Today we'll begin with Syria Part 2. So listeners may remember that we played Syria Part 1 last week. And this is an interview between Jan Bartlett of Tuesday Home Time and Tim Anderson. It's extremely illuminating. So that will be the first thing.
And after that, we're going to have a chat with someone over in Aotearoa. Mr. Eugene Doyle, he's a writer based in Wellington, and we're going to chat about a recent three-part series that he wrote regarding the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Ho Chi Minh City and the victory of the Vietnamese over the American imperialists, and go into... I found his articles really illuminating because there were lots of things I didn't know about, you know, what it was actually like at the time during the war for particularly the Americans and allies like Australians. And we'll go into some of those interesting details.
And then after that, we'll be talking to the Anti-Poverty Network in South Australia about what they would like to see the new government do, given that they have this large majority and they can take action on things that Labour actually stands for. So let's see what they're wanting from the Labour government. And then, hopefully, we will be looking at... OpenAI and Meta, and the talking to Dr. Agata Merva Montoya, who has published an article on The Conversation about Meta and using pirated books to train AI. So we'll be talking to them about copyright and artificial intelligence and why there are problems.
Lots of problems. But that's about all we've got for lots of things, I should say. And maybe also I can say that my name's Jesse, and we're here with
Nita as well,
and I'm Sonia here. Yes. Behind the panel today, and we should also say, of course, thank you to Earth Matters for the show that came on before that. I love seed saving. And so it was making me happy to hear people talking about saving seeds. I love the bottom-up kind of activism that's literally reshaping the earth.
So important when the logging companies and mining companies insist on destroying and
the large agricultural companies are trying to maintain a stranglehold of what we can and cannot grow, and take what's often indigenous knowledge and privatize it and corporatize it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting there's a word for seed saving. That's literally just keeping some seeds to grow again, right? Which is how we've humans have grown their food for millennia, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And now it's being made almost illegal in some parts of the world. So
crazy.
It was, a really interesting show, I thought.
Yes, I have to listen.
Shall we go into today's news headlines?
Yes.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it,
gritty now, yeah, boom. Nitty gritty, hoo-wee. Right down to the real nitty gritty.
And these are the news headlines for this Wednesday, the 7th of May, 2025. It's 5 minutes past seven. You're listening to Wednesday Breakfast on 3CR. Beginning with Romania's government collapsed into chaos after Prime Minister Marcel Ciolacu stepped down on Monday, responding to the shock first-round presidential election victory of far-right nationalist George Simion. The ruling Social Democratic Party, PSD, withdrew from its coalition with the National Liberal Party, PNL, abandoning its candidate Crin Antonescu, who failed to secure a runoff spot. Simion, leader of the ultranationalist AUR party, capitalized on anti-establishment anger with a campaign railing against EU integration and mainstream politics. Ciolacu's resignation forces Romania into a caretaker government for 45 days, with no clear path to a stable majority, as fears grow over the country's democratic trajectory. Simion's ascent, marked by vows to defy Western alliances and stoke nationalist sentiment, reflects deepening disillusionment with centrist coalitions accused of neglecting economic inequality and sovereignty concerns. The PSD's decision not to endorse any candidate in the runoff has left voters adrift, amplifying warnings of democratic backsliding. Analysts link the turmoil to last year's annulled elections, which critics claim exposed vulnerabilities to foreign interference. As Romania grapples with a fractured political landscape, the crisis underscores the region's struggle to balance EU integration with rising anti-elite fury, offering a cautionary tale for left-wing movements failing to address grassroots demands for reform.
Next, a landmark minerals agreement signed between the United States and Ukraine on the 30th of April has upended the strategic calculus in Eastern Europe, tilting momentum towards Kyiv after months of fierce lobbying by both Ukraine and Russia to sway the Trump administration. The deal, hailed by President Volodymyr Zelensky as truly equal, grants Washington access to Ukraine's vast critical mineral reserves, largely concentrated west of the Dnieper River, while bolstering Kyiv's military and economic ties to the West. Zelensky's diplomatic win solidifies his national credentials and quashes rumors of regime change, even as Moscow grapples with the collapse of its hopes for neutral Ukraine. The pact, which nearly derailed U.S. aid negotiations, signals a long-term Western foothold in the region, with analysts warning it could spur Russia to escalate hostilities to secure Black Sea territories and buffer zones east of the Dnieper River. While the minerals deal reboots Western alliances, it exposes fissures in U.S.-Russia relations, with President Donald Trump walking a tightrope between appeasing Moscow and advancing American economic interests. Though Trump has dangled recognition of Crimea as Russian territory, the agreement effectively dashes Kremlin aims for Ukrainian neutrality, raising stakes for Putin's stalled denazification campaign. With Zelensky now openly embracing revanchist rhetoric, including claims of assassinating Russian generals, Moscow faces mounting pressure to pursue outright military victory before Trump's potential exit. Meanwhile, European powers eye Ukraine's growing military clout as a linchpin for continental security, even as the Kremlin signals readiness to exhaust adversaries through prolonged conflict. As Trump hinted, concessions clash with congressional resistance to lifting sanctions. The war's trajectory hinges on whether Russia accepts a frozen front or doubles down to reshape Ukraine's future and its own by force.
Facing significant economic burdens, including substantial debt to Western-dominated financial institutions and restrictive trade actions from the United States, Kenyan President William Ruto has concluded a pivotal state visit to China. His third trip since taking office saw the signing of over 20 wide-ranging bilateral agreements, significantly deepening ties with Beijing across critical areas like infrastructure development, trade expansion, and technological cooperation, signalling a clear strategic recalibration towards Eastern partners. Elevating relations to a comprehensive strategic partnership, the visit prioritised resurrecting stalled infrastructure projects like the Standard Gauge Railway and forging pathways to expand Kenyan exports into Asian markets, explicitly aiming to reduce reliance on traditional Western destinations. This assertive move reflects a glowing global trend where nations seek genuinely mutually beneficial partnerships and development models, pushing back against the conditionalities and limitations often encountered within Western economic and political frameworks.
And April 30 marked 50 years since the end of the American War in Vietnam, a conflict that claimed an estimated 3.3 million Vietnamese lives, hundreds of thousands of Cambodians, tens of thousands Laotians, and over 58,000 U.S. service members. Yet, for survivors, veterans, and their descendants, the war's devastation endures. Decades after the last bombs fell, communities across Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and the U.S. grapple with the catastrophic aftermath of Agent Orange, a toxic herbicide sprayed by the U.S. military to destroy forests and crops. Containing dioxin, a lethal chemical, the defoliant has caused congenital disabilities, cancers, and chronic illnesses across generations. Despite a 1973 pledge to provide $3 billion for post-war recovery, the U.S. has never compensated Vietnamese victims, leaving millions to endure untreated health crises and environmental contamination. In a bid to address this historic injustice, Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democratic in Michigan, introduced a landmark legislative bill package on April 28, the Agent Orange Relief Act of 2025, mandates medical care for Vietnamese victims, environmental cleanup of dioxin hotspots, and health assessments for affected Vietnamese American communities. A companion bill, the Victims of Agent Orange Act of 2025, extends benefits to children of male U.S. veterans born with congenital anomalies, a group excluded under current laws. Tlaib, backed by advocacy groups like Veterans for Peace in Vietnam, Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign, called the bills an act of repair for U.S. war crimes. As we mark 50 years since withdrawal, it's time to heal these wounds, she stated, emphasizing the moral urgency of addressing untreated diseases, disabilities, and intergenerational trauma. The legislation faces an uphill battle in Congress, but has reignited calls for accountability. Between 2.1 million and 4.8 million Vietnamese, Laotians, and Cambodians, alongside tens of thousands of Americans, were directly exposed to Agent Orange, with contamination persisting in soil and food chains. Survivors like Mai Giang Vu, whose sons died young from Agent Orange-linked disabilities, and French-Vietnamese journalist Na Tran, whose children suffered fatal genetic disorders, underscore the human toll. While the U.S. has funded limited cleanup efforts and compensates veterans, Vietnamese victims remain unrecognized. Advocates argue that passing Tlaib's bill is critical to fulfilling long-overdue obligations and confronting a war's unfinished reckoning.
Tasmania's Ashley Youth Detention Centre, long criticised for systemic failures and linked to historical abuse scandals, will remain open until at least early 2028 after the state government delayed its closure for the third time. Initially slated to shut by late 2024, following a 2023 inquiry into institutionalised child sexual abuse, the timeline was first pushed to 2026 and now 2028, pending the completion of a replacement facility in Pontville. The new 16-bed Tasmanian Youth Justice Facility, touted as a best practice therapeutic centre, aims to prioritise rehabilitation and community safety. Tasmanian Minister for Children and Youth, Roger Janesh, defended the delay, stating, "We cannot close Ashley before we have a new functional detention facility, with construction expected to finish by late 2027. The decision comes amid heightened security over the disproportionate representation of Aboriginal youth in Tasmania's justice system. First Nations children aged 10 to 17 are four times more likely to be under supervision than non-Indigenous peers, comprising 31% of detained youth, despite being just 10% of the state's youth population. Last month, the government launched a consultation period for its Tasmanian Aboriginal Youth Justice Strategy, backed by Indigenous leaders like Uncle Rodney Dillon, who emphasised the need for Aboriginal-led solutions to reduce recidivism. "We've got to develop things that stop kids from staying in the system," Dillon said, advocating for culturally informed interventions. Currently, 14 people are detained at Ashley, though the number of Aboriginal youths remains undisclosed. The government insists that the Pontville facility will adopt a, quote, child-centred therapeutic model to address root causes of offending, alongside investments in diversion programs. Critics, however, argue repeated delays undermine urgent reforms, with advocates stressing that Tasmania's marginalised communities cannot wait another 4 years for systemic change. As debates over justice and accountability continue, the fate of Ashley's vulnerable detainees hangs in the balance.
And news just that seems to be coming in is that India has launched what they're calling precision strike attacks at terrorist camps in Pakistan. That happened early hours of this morning, coming in the wake of the terrorist attacks in India. Pakistan is saying that it's civilian targets that have been hit, including one mosque. So that's out now, and really quite terrifying news with two nuclear powers launching, well, one launching missiles at another and the other largely expected to retaliate. And that's it for news headlines for today, Wednesday the 7th of May. Shall we move on to our first item for the morning?
Yes, sounds good. Got a packed show.
Yeah, let's certainly do that. So this is the long-awaited History of Syria Part 2. We played History of Syria Part 1 last week if you wanted to have a listen. And this entire recording can also be found on the 15th of April, Tuesday home time. So today we listened to Tim Anderson continuing to speak to John Bartlett of Tuesday Home Time about the recent history of Syria, from the Sykes-Picot Agreement and Western colonization to the strong resistance of Syria to imperialism, including supporting the Palestinian armed resistance, up to the present-day collapse of the Assad government at the hands of Western Zionist and Turkish proxies, HTS. Have a listen.
Just wondering what the people of Syria feel about the fact that Assad left the country.
A lot of people who were close to the president are angry, very angry with him in the way that he left, basically, that he'd said that he was going to live and he was born in Syria, he was going to die in Syria. He wouldn't run away like the former president of Ukraine ran away in 2014 when there was a coup orchestrated against him by the US. But nevertheless, he did run away. And, you know, there are all sorts of excuses. I think his son has put up some on the internet, but no one really knows and no one was given warning. So actually some of the people who were the closest to him are quite angry that they were basically abandoned to their fate at that time.
Talk about the groups that have now taken over. We hear the name of Jilani and others, but who are they? You've talked about some of the groups, but how have they coalesced to take over?
So they changed over time. Jilani was one of the Syrian leaders of those groups because some of the groups had Saudi leaders and Turkestan leaders, Chechen leaders, and so on. Jilani was actually a Syrian of Salafi persuasion. You know, Salafism is this extreme sectarian Saudi Arabian type of ideology where you can attack people because they are not of the correct faith, basically. That ideology really was very marginalized. It didn't really exist in Syria. Syria had a famous pluralist culture, you know, basically inclusive. They talk about it as being secular. But to my mind, when the Syrians talk about secular, they meant pluralist. It meant that, for example, the president appointed a grand mufti whose job it was to respect and go around and join the Christians and the Druze and the various types of Muslims and so on and support them in a pluralist system, you know, to say there was room for everyone there. Syria was famous as a haven for minorities, basically. You know, the Druze went there because they knew it was famous as a haven for minorities. The Alawis also, and many other minorities, the Circassians from the Caucasus. There were many, many, and still are many, many minorities in Syria, but they're having an extremely hard time now, basically. They're the target. They have a target of a lot of hate from these sectarian groups, which the Western media wrongly calls Sunni groups. You know, you can say they're Sunni in the sense of the mainstream, but they're an extremist Takfiri, Salafi version of Sunni Islam. They don't represent Sunni Islam generally, but they use the word Sunni to give themselves some sort of status and to claim quite falsely that Sunnis were discriminated against in Syria. The Sunni Muslims are the majority in Syria, have always been, but most of them liked this idea of a pluralist state where there wasn't an extreme religious state, basically. In fact, many of them were very strongly opposed to any sort of religious state, which is unique in the region, really. Syria, until late last year, was virtually the only genuinely pluralist. You can't say there was no elements of religion in the state, because there was. A lot of the civil law was Sharia law in terms of marriage and things like that, but really Syria was as far away from religious state as you get in that part of the world.
The focus since December has been the attempted genocide of the Alawite people. Can you talk a bit more about that, and are they the only ones who have been targeted, or are they targeting other minorities as well?
For the last question, yes, they're targeting other minorities. The slogan in the so-called Syrian Revolution, in which I documented in my book, The Dirty War on Syria, in 2011, we have it from April and May 2011, very early days of the uprising in Syria. The main slogan from the Muslim Brotherhood groups was Christians to Beirut, Alawis to the grave. In other words, they wanted the Christians out to Lebanon, and they wanted to kill the Alawis. Now, the Alawis were a minority, really a disadvantaged minority. They weren't, you know, prominent amongst the most wealthy people. The Damascus Chamber of Commerce was dominated by Sunni Muslim merchants, basically. The big landowners were Sunni Muslims, so it's wrong to say that the Alawis dominated the economy of Syria. But what happened was they were a group in the mountains on the coast to start with, where they went to escape earlier caliphates, basically. A lot of the minorities went into the mountains to escape the caliphate or religious rule in the past, basically. But the Alawis found a way forward through the army. So there was developed quite a strong tradition of Alawis going into the army. And indeed, any time under the Bashar al-Assad government, if you looked around the army, you would find that it was very popular, for one thing, because all of the sects of the country were in the army, whether as regular soldiers or conscripts. But also, they were represented. You know, the majority of the soldiers were Sunni Muslims, and there was Christians, and there was Alawis, and so on. But in the officer ranks, there was an over-representation of Alawis, because there was this tradition, a little bit like the Sikhs in India, basically, that this was one of the ways forward for them as a minority, basically. So many of the generals and colonels and so on were from the coast. And the Alawi sect itself, and there's a version of it in Turkey called the Alevis. They themselves will say they're very different, but to a Western eye, they look quite similar. They're more, in a sense, more liberal Muslims. Most of the women don't wear hijabs. The men sometimes drink alcohol. Of course, actually, in Syria, it didn't matter what religion you were. A lot of people drink alcohol in Syria. But they were basically less extreme version of Muslims to the Western eye, the Alawis. You would think culturally they would be closer to the West, but in the end, the West chose to demonize them because politically it suited the West to actually ally themselves with extreme sectarian terrorists from the Saudi Arabian type of culture, basically. So the Alawis were then linked to the army. And so when this revenge killings began, first of all, there was a sectarian ideology, the Salafism, which says someone who is pretending to be a Muslim but not really a Muslim, you know, some sort of apostate, like the minority sects of Islam, which, to, you know, incorporate, they synthesized their own versions of religious philosophy, basically, and created sects like the Ismailis and so on. And the Shia and the Alawis, they were all considered targets just because of their religion. But with the Alawis in Syria, it was additionally the fact that many of them were commanders in the army, and the army for more than a decade was killing terrorist groups, ISIS, Nusra, HTS, and so a lot of the comrades of the current regime in Damascus were killed by the Syrian Arab Army. Now, when they took over in December, most of the commanders fled, but you're left with the community, you know, the civilian communities of the Alawis, who are now being accused of being, what do they call it? They've got an expression, remnants of the old regime, remnants of the Syrian army, who killed their comrades in the past, you know, in Aleppo, in Raqqa, in Deir ez-Zor, in different places. Of course, they were doing that. And as I said, HTS itself is still listed by the UN Security Council as sectarian terrorists. So they were right in doing that. Basically, I think anyone who saw clearly what was going on in Syria over the more than 10 years of the dirty war would have to accept the fact that the Syrian army was doing exactly what a national army should do. It was getting rid of the enemies of the nation, those who were trying to divide the nation, trying to sell it out to foreign powers, and trying to divide up a genuinely pluralist system, which was all inclusive, into a sectarian regime where they would demonize some minorities and try to elevate, under the name of Sunni Islam, which was an unfair label, basically, try to elevate themselves, basically. But the Christians have suffered some attacks, and there's this pressure, the idea that they should be in Lebanon, basically, because that was set up as some sort of Christian enclave. And then you've got Ismailis, you've got Circassians, you've got Shia. A lot of the Shia actually sought political asylum a few months ago, I think in January, and I think many of them were granted political asylum in Iraq, which Iraq is a majority Shia state too, you know, so The Iraqis are very alarmed, by the way, at the terrorist takeover of Damascus, because they're the same people, basically, they fought for many years in Iraq. You know, the US used Takfiri terrorism against Iraq in exactly the same way that they use it against Syria. And, of course, I might add here, just by way of lateral thinking, that you see a very similar tactic going in North Africa. Many North and West African countries are facing the same sort of threat. The US will foment Takfiri terrorism and then present themselves as the saviors, come here to fight terrorism. That's what they did with Iraq. And they got some consent from the Iraqi, to weaken the Iraqi government, and they did it with Syria without the consent from the Syrian government, saying we are here to fight terrorism, when in fact they were fomenting it and using it as a pretext to carry out their occupation and seize control of the region, of the resources, divide and weaken any government that stood up against them.
Is Israel sitting back and watching all this happening or not?
No, they're actively involved. They were party to the idea of the HTS invasion. They supported it with airstrikes. In previous years, the Israelis had actively used their missiles and airstrikes coming in from the Mediterranean, usually, because they had one plane shot down when it went over Syria a few years ago. So Syria, under Bashar al-Assad, still had some air defense. So it was able to defend Syria to a certain extent, but not strong enough to respond in kind to the many Israeli attacks. So the Israelis were attacking Syria, parts of the Syrian army. They claimed they were attacking Iranian advisors or whatever, or arms dumps which were going to Hezbollah. And there were weapons systems that were being manufactured in Syria and sent to Hezbollah and to the Palestinian resistance. So that much was true. But the Israelis then, of course, you saw immediately after the takeover of Damascus that the Israeli army came in from the south through the occupied Golan, went through Daraa, Qunaitra, into countryside Damascus and almost reached Damascus, basically. They are still occupying large parts of southern Syria. They claim it's temporary, some sort of buffer zone, but we know their practices in the past, in the Golan, in the West Bank. They go in somewhere and then they talk about buffer zones and then they use it as a pretext to extend their occupation, their colonization. It seems very likely that's what they're doing there now. They had some other pretext for doing that. They were talking about protecting the Druze community, which indeed is true that the Druze community don't want an HTS government because the Druze themselves are seen as a apostate sect which HTS would attack and kill, and indeed their predecessors did attack and kill many Druze people, I think in Hama in the past. But they've had a little bit of safety in Sweden because the Israelis have been talking about protecting them, and HTS has decided not to engage in a battle with the Druze militia. They've always had independent militia in Sweden Mountain, for example. But it seems now that some of the promises the Israelis made to the Druze are being withdrawn. They were promising work visas for them to go and work in Israel in occupied Palestine. Indeed, there have always been a Druze community in occupied Palestine, including so-called 1948 Palestine, basically. But that promise has been withdrawn, and now there are protests in Sweda and in parts of southeast Damascus, where there are a lot of Druze minority in Jarumana, for example, very big southeast suburb of Damascus, where they're protesting against and calling for the overthrow of the HTS regime with the same words that were used back in the Arab Spring in 2011. So the Druze are caught in a very difficult place, but they are a group that can't be ignored either.
Well, finally, Tim, are Western nations content to allow HTS to continue?
I think they're in a dilemma, because this whole idea that the US has run across the Middle East, the West Asia, and in North Africa and West Africa has been that we are here to help you fight terrorism. You know, remember the so-called war on terrorism that George Bush initiated, you know, with 9/11. The pretext for that is that they are seen as being able to contribute something to fighting terrorism and not actually fomenting it against countries. And if they support an HTS regime in Damascus openly, I mean, they're supporting it now, but if they support it officially and openly, that'll undermine their case for intervention in all across North Africa and across West Asia, basically. So it's difficult. I think there's two possibilities. They can ignore or abandon, just ignore what's going on in Syria, because they got what they want. Really, Jalani did his job. He got rid of an independent regime in Damascus. Whether they recognize it and try and get involved in some way as they did in Iraq, I think there's two possibilities. The Libyan situation where they said, we'll let the Libyans, we'll let this sectarian violence go on for a decade and Libya will become destroyed and we'll steal their resources on the side. Or in the Iraqi case, they tried to sectarianize the country. They did that. They set up a sectarian constitution. They created a federation, basically. They manipulated the constitutional process in Iraq. And now they have a weak government, which they can manipulate to a fair degree. It's regaining a little bit of political will, but basically there is still sectarian divides in Iraq which suit the US, and the US still has an occupation there. So if they're going to recognize a new regime in Damascus, and there are some signs of a movement in this direction, they have to have some token people, you know, like token women, token Christians, token Alawis. And indeed, apparently, there are a couple of junior ministers who've been appointed from those groups, you know, to get in there and play the token part and make it look like there are collaborators and this is some sort of genuine coalition and not just a regime formed by a UN-recognized, a UN-certified sectarian terrorist group, basically. It's difficult for them. And, of course, China and Russia aren't going to change their line on the registration of HTS as terrorists in a hurry. China has said so. The Russians are in a slightly different situation because they're talking about trying to hang on to the airbase and the naval base they have on the coast in Syria. So I think the US seems to be moving to a situation where they're trying to push Jalani. And Jalani himself is difficult because he was a commander of ISIS and a commander of Nusra before being a commander of HTS. So there's no, it's very difficult for them to try and completely whitewash the history of Jalani and the many crimes that he was associated with. But they seem to be moving a bit in that direction to try and include some other token members of the new regime from minority groups. Maybe that's the way in which they're going.
I've been speaking with Dr. Tim Anderson, member of the international group Hands Off Syria.
And just as you've heard, that was part two of a two-part interview that we played with for the first part of last week with Tim Anderson from Jan Bartlett's Tuesday Home Time about the recent history of Syria and from the Sykes-Picot Agreement and Western colonization and the recent developments. We'll head to some community announcements and be back in a second.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
It will not address the deep underlying issues that still pervade Australian society. And that primary issue is white Australian racism.
We've got a clear-cut case here of intentional genocide from the get-go, from the round table in England.
The true history in this country isn't told. The government always say that they're committed to a truth-telling process. Well, where is your truth-telling process?
I really believe that at the end of the day, the truth will emerge. You can't fight against the truth. It's an unstoppable force. It's indestructible. So deal with it.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
And you're back with us on Wednesday breakfast, 8:55 a.m. You might be listening to us on the internet, on the website, 3cr.org.au. You might be listening in the future. Hello to all future people. We hope the future is bright. And you might be listening to us on the community radio app as well. You can get that on your phone or maybe other places that have apps. I'm not sure. but for now, we're going to head to an interview with Eugene Doyle, who is a writer based in Wellington. And Eugene has written extensively on the Middle East, as well as peace and security issues in the Asia-Pacific region, and hosts the public policy platform solidarity.co.nz. And we're chatting with Eugene over in Wellington. And we wanted to chat with you, Eugene, because you've just put out published a great three-part series on the 50th anniversary of the American War in Vietnam. And I read that piece and found a lot of information that I hadn't come across before, which I thought was really interesting. So thanks so much for joining us this morning, Eugene.
Hey, great to be on your station and to mark an incredibly important anniversary, which I think got fairly lightly played in Australia. Would that be right? Was there much media coverage?
No, there was nearly nothing, although I do get on my news feeds a lot of stuff about the so-called fall of Saigon, and that's often the way it's characterized, I think, in the media here and especially in the US. But I just find that to be an interesting way of characterizing it, and maybe a way of describing the event for people who are into imperialism and colonialism and not people who are into sovereignty and upholding your country's legitimate rights to independence.
Hey, well said, because yes, Saigon fell on the 30th April 1975, so that's 50 years ago, and as you quite rightly said, there's another way of framing it, that it was one of the great victories, one of the great liberation struggles that really needs to be remembered, because, you know, that victory went on and inspired liberation struggles all over the world. The fact that despite horrific violence by, you know, particularly by the Americans, they killed over 2 million people, some people say up to 3 million, in that war, you know, just vast scale war crimes, the Vietnamese people in the end triumphed and drove the Americans and you know, the Australians and New Zealanders were there too in the course of the war. So yeah, I think a lot to celebrate there in a way. Hey, and I'd say too, like, for a lot of younger people, you go, Vietnam War is sort of so long ago, so barely understand it. And I just want to say these things are really, really important to understand, because, you know, as William Faulkner said, the past is never dead. It's not even past. That, you know, we live with this stuff. When you look at Gaza and you look at what happened in Iraq and you look at what's happening now and These continue a pattern that was well established, you know, in wars like the Korean War. Most people have forgotten now. The Americans killed 3 million people in Korea. They killed a similar number in Indochina, including Vietnam. You know, so unless we sort of understand these struggles and really confront our past, what you end up with is repetition. It just keeps on happening again and again.
Absolutely. And yesterday I came across a bit of an analysis, and it was looking at the way that people's attitudes towards the Second World War have changed in terms of their understanding of who was most responsible for the victory against fascism. And in the, you know, around the sort of after the Second World War, you know, people understood that, you know, it was actually the Red Army in the USSR who lost 27 million troops fighting fascism. But then, the closer you get to the current period, the more people understand that or believe that it was America and the Allied forces who were the ones who fought and won that victory. So it's, as you say, it's incredibly important that we understand the history and the truth of the matter, which is why I wanted to chat with you, and I wanted to ask in the beginning, what began the war. You know, I've read about the Gulf of Tonkin incident and the domino theory. How did that sort of play out, and how did the American troops and Australian troops end up actually on the ground in Vietnam?
Sure. Well, yeah, it was quite a long process, because you had the French in there, you know, before the Americans. So it was a French colony. They got booted out by The Japanese took over, the French snuck back after the war, and then the Vietnamese actually gave them a thorough kicking. They surrounded 50,000 French troops and said, if you don't permanently leave the country, we'll wipe them. And that was the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. And that's what happened. The French abandoned Vietnam and got the hell out of there. Unfortunately, the Americans then became the new guys in town, and they just progressively entered the country. And the thing you mentioned, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, that was sort of like the Americans always like to get their wars off to a start with a good lie, and they said that a couple of their ships got in the Gulf of Tonkin, you know, off the coast of Vietnam, by the North Vietnamese, and that was sort of the excuse to accelerate increased U.S. involvement. That was under President Lyndon B. Johnson. And then, of course, as these things happen, you expand a war, you increase your involvement, and then with a big power like the United States, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and that's what happened there. The Americans had this idea that you touched on called the domino theory, that you know, if we don't stop them in Vietnam, they'll be sort of the commies will be having linguine in Sydney next week, sort of thing. You know, that Asia would fall, and you know, it was this sort of epic battle against communism, which, as history has proven, was, you know, that didn't happen. Just as, you know, like I think what you're seeing in Ukraine, the part of the argument is that if we don't stop them in Ukraine, they'll be having coffee and strudel in Vienna next week, which also I don't think is going to happen.
Yes, thanks for that. And so there was a couple of, I guess, important things that have happened as part of the war. The American War, and there were things that after reading your three-part series that I wasn't really aware of, or maybe I'd heard of but didn't quite understand. So I wanted to ask you about those. And the first one was the My Lai Massacre. Could you tell us a bit about what that was?
Yeah, look, the My Lai Massacre was, you know, like quite an astonishing event on the 16th of where part of the U.S. 20th Infantry Regiment, you know, they've been fighting in a very hot area, but they went into a village which didn't appear to have any Viet Cong or, you know, North Vietnamese forces in there. And they basically spent several hours, multiple hours, raping, torturing, killing the civilian population there. About 500 people got killed. And an old guy, Seymour Hersh, today, he was a young journalist, and he was one of the ones who broke rank, who actually uncovered the story and took it to the world, and it exploded internationally. It was a really important story. But what it turned out was that those kind of massacres happened on multiple occasions, you know, like thousands and thousands of years by the Western forces, and as we know, hundreds of thousands of children killed, and as we know, you know, a couple of million people total killed. And so that kind of reporting just exploded a lot of the myths about the American war in Vietnam. And it was really heroic journalists like Seymour Hersh, like Australia's own John Pilger, you know, just astonishingly brave and courageous reporting that broke ranks and actually brought the truth of the conflict, the really sordid reality, to the world's gaze. And that was actually quite an important part in undermining popular support for the war. And you know, over the course of a number of years, of course, everyone got a thorough guts.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
And thoroughly understood what a despicable business the Vietnam War was. You know, the enormous bombing campaigns, the huge number of massacres of civilians, the deployment of just astonishing quantities of chemical weapons on both the civilians and on the food production for the ordinary people of Vietnam. And once those stories were thoroughly understood, support for the war really fell through the floor.
Mm. Just highlights the importance of course, of getting the truth out there. And from what I understand, after the Vietnam War, the U.S. Army and government sort of put a lot more effort into trying to control journalists and, the so-called embedded journalists into the army itself. And they were, taken around and shown only what the U.S. wants them to see. And that was sort of what has now been passed for journalism, war journalism, I should say. And I wanted to go ask you about the Phoenix program, because that wasn't something I'd heard about either before reading your publications.
Sure. Look, actually, I'm not an expert on the Phoenix program, but the Americans ran a number of activities. That one there, the Phoenix program, was run by the CIA. So it's a really, if people want to learn more about it, just look up Douglas Valentine. He's a US journalist who's written extensively on it. And it was just incredibly sordid stuff. You know, they'd go into villages and they deliberately targeted. They didn't target fighters. They targeted civilians and tried to intimidate them and, killed huge numbers of them, committed all sorts of depravities. And once again, a lot of this ends up getting covered up. So things like the Phoenix program and all of this just end up being hit, and the My Lai massacre, just all got hidden from view. Oh, the other thing I've got to say about the My Lai massacre, what was astonishing was they killed 500 civilians, hundreds of women got raped and all of this sort of thing. And only one soldier, Lieutenant Kelly got convicted of a crime. He got given a sentence, and then 3 days later, the U.S. president commuted that to home detention, a lightly enforced home detention, which is this terrible business that these crimes, the Americans never face up to the crimes they commit, so they just go on and repeat them again and again and again, which comes back to my point about, understanding history is really important, because otherwise you end up with repetition, and that's what we're seeing today, and with these horrific crimes being committed by the U.S. and Israel in Gaza and the West Bank.
Yeah, absolutely. And even just remembering or recalling David McBride, and he's obviously in jail for reporting on Australian war crimes in Afghanistan, over 100, I believe. And of course, none of those war crimes have been investigated, or none of the people involved in those have been brought to justice. But the person who spoke about them, David McBride, is now in jail.
Well, that's the standard policy. You get punished for telling the truth or exposing the truth. Yeah, that's a standard Western policy.
And we've also, this is Sonia here, and I've from Malaysia originally. And I mean, it's a policy that we see with other colonial powers in Southeast Asia as well. The UK, the British massacres that occurred of particularly Chinese communists, they not only went unpunished, people were celebrated for them, even when they were seen to be the Batankali massacre, for example, recognized as crimes against humanity, but they were still the people who committed them. Ended up with military honours and safe retirement and things.
Yes, absolutely true, yeah.
Another thing that I learned from your piece, Eugene, was about the level of how to describe it. There was desertion by soldiers and something called fragging, and just the despair and depression and the level of disengagement and, but I guess maybe an extreme version of that in amongst the U.S. Army and allies in Vietnam. And I wanted to ask you a bit about what was happening there.
Actually, well, was described once again by that brilliant Australian journalist, John Pilger, only died a year or so back. He called it the quiet mutiny. So, and very few people know this today, the American Army, the vast American Army, was on the edge of a proper full-blown mutiny. By the early 1970s, you had hundreds of thousands of US troops in the country, and they couldn't put an effective army in the field. They could bomb the hell out of the place. They could fly over the top of villages and shoot them up in helicopters, but they couldn't actually put an effective army in. Level of discontent by the front line. So the guys who were right at the front, who were called the grunts. There were about 80,000 of them, and they had a thorough gutsful of the war. The guys right at the front didn't believe in the war, and they sort of morphed. From when these sort of best of the best of the best Marine type boys, clean cut, you know, spit and polish boys hit the beaches in the late 60s. By the early 70s, these jokers had peace logos on their helmets. They refused to cut their hair. They had, you know, long hair, and they smoked a lot of pot, and some of them took heroin, and they had this thing. I was completely stunned when I was 12 years old. I took out a subscription to Newsweek, and it described fragging. And what were you fragging? It was killing your own off. What we learned later was there were a guy who did a terrific job called Soldiers in Revolt, GI Resistance During the Vietnam War, David Courtright, who was himself a Vietnam veteran, but he went on to become a distinguished academic. And he documented over 900 incidents of fragging, killing of officers, including 500 by explosive devices. And the typical one was that the troops would flick hand grenades, what they called a fragmentation device, you know, because it fragments, and that was fragging. And that if there was some officer who they didn't like because he was putting them in danger or whatever, and they had a guts for it, they didn't want to fight the Vietnamese, they'd just flick a hand grenade into his tent, fragging. So you had an army on the edge of rebellion, which was another one of these reasons why the effectiveness of the, you know, the biggest, greatest army in history was not sufficient to defeat the Vietnamese, or, you know, the PVNA. That's quite an incredible story. And John Pilger actually said a beautiful thing. He did this piece to camera in a documentary called The Vietnam, The Quiet Mutiny, that came out in 1970. And he said this thing, this short piece of camera, he said, the war is ending because the largest, wealthiest, and most powerful organization on earth, the American Army, has been challenged from within by the most brutalized and certainly the bravest of its members. The war is ending because the grunt is taking no more bullshit, end quote. And that played on, you know, mainstream television. It was, I mean, the chair of was it Granada, I think, he when he found out that this had gone to air, he described Pilger as a threat to Western civilization, which I thought was brilliant. But and today you just wouldn't get a piece to camera like that done on the mainstream media. You know, that was, you know, quite epic and heroic by one of your Australian journalists.
Thanks, Eugene. I John Pilger certainly played a huge role in my political education, and I'm still yet to watch all of his documentaries, but I have a huge appreciation for his bravery and journalism. He's had a huge impact on so many people, as I'm sure you're aware. And so I guess we're sort of coming towards the end of our discussion, and I did want to ask you a bit about, once the Vietnamese were victorious in holding on to their sovereignty and kicking out the Americans and Australians from their country. Of course, that wasn't the end of it. The US and the West, they put a whole bunch of sanctions and tried to crush them through economic means. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Now, and you have to say, one of the things that complicates the story is there was a genuine civil war within Vietnam. So you had, people who were pro-Western, people who were the elites in society, they tended to line up with the Americans, and ordinary folks tended to line up with the the great leader was Ho Chi Minh, and they gathered around the communist cause, not so much because they were communists, but because they were nationalists, that they really wanted to get rid of the colonial powers. They fought the French, they fought the Japanese, and then they subsequently fought and defeated the Americans and the likes of Australia and New Zealand. And so at the end of the war, a lot of people were very scared of the transition, and that was understandable. And you had this phenomenon. Do you remember the boat people?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So you had, I think, up to a couple of million people fled the country. Part of the reason they fled was because the American sanctions were so brutal, so effective, that the Americans, in their typical fashion, seized the millions of dollars that the Vietnamese had overseas. So they did that classic trick. They blocked IMF loans. So your country's recovering from war, you need money to reconstruct. The Americans made sure none of that happened. So there were a lot of economic refugees, political refugees, etc. The boat people who and quite a few obviously ended up in Australia, and quite a few of them, perhaps up to a quarter of a million, died in the waters. So it wasn't a rosy sort of initial result. But what you actually got in the end was, by 1986, they actually looked over at the Chinese and went, wow, the Chinese under Deng Xiaoping, they did this economic miracle where they did this sort of mixed socialist market economy thing. And as in China, the Vietnamese economy absolutely boomed. And so you're in a position today where ordinary people are, in terms of education, health, all of those things, are doing incredibly well. What's not quite so rosy is that it's still a tightly controlled political environment. They've got an absolutely terrible positions on things like press freedom and all of that. So that's nothing whatsoever to celebrate, all of that. But I do think the great achievement of the Vietnamese people to actually get their independence from the foreign powers and have turned themselves into a highly successful economy today, which, despite Trump's round of tariffs, the Vietnamese people really showed that they could stand up on their own feet and create, a really dynamic economy. I think there's a lot to celebrate there.
Absolutely. I'm really sorry, Eugene, we've run out of time, but it's been a real pleasure speaking with you and getting more clarity on the American War in Vietnam and on the 50th anniversary. And people can go and check out your public policy platform. It's solidarity.co.nz. Is there anything else where people can come and find you, or anything else you wanted to mention before we say goodbye this morning?
That's a good one.
Yep.
Yeah, that's great one. Solidarity.co.nz. And I just do a shout out to Pearls and Irritations, the Australian website. You know, I get published in various places. That series was actually a monthly review in New York and Asia Pacific Report, various places. But Pearls and Irritation is an outstanding Australian platform. Give them a shout. Hey, if it's all right with you, I'll just wrap up with a three-line poem by Ho Chi Minh himself, I believe, when you think of everything the Vietnamese people went through, and they gave everything, to actually win that war. And from his prison diary, Ho Chi Minh said, "After the rain, good weather. In the wink of an eye, the universe throws off its muddy clothes."
Love Uncle Ho. Thanks so much, Eugene. Hope to speak again with you soon, and have a great day over there in New Zealand, Aotearoa.
Kia ora. Yeah, really appreciate it, Jesse. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.
And you're listening to 3CR, 855 AM. It's Wednesday, the 7th of May, and this is Wednesday Breakfast. Let's now go to a song. Jesse, I think you've got one lined up.
Yes, just let me plug in
that's quite
this thing over here, yeah. And then I'll...
Maybe I'll go to a quick announcement first, and then we can... let's do that.
Your boy Race Rage, Jamaica Moana.
Hey, it's your boy Race Rage, and you're here on 8:55 AM on 3CR.
And that was AIM by Tamsin P and Pataphysics, excellent local Melbourne hip-hop group. Check them out. They're incredible and underrated.
And now we're going to go to an interview with Pass Forgione. Have I pronounced that correctly?
Forgione.
From the Anti-Poverty Network in South Australia. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, tell us a little bit about your centre, please.
Yeah, well, the Anti-Poverty Network is a grassroots, a volunteer-run community organisation, and our members and supporters largely are people who are directly affected by the poverty crisis, the housing crisis. So people on the Centrelink payments, such as job seekers, students, and pensioners and carers and sole parents, but also renters, essentially people who have to battle the twin challenges of trying to survive on very, very low incomes while dealing with our absolutely out of control housing market, where we've seen massive increases in rents over the last several years and nationwide shortages in public housing. Of course, our goal is to advocate for the radical action that we need to solve both of these crises, and to ensure that, because this is an incredibly wealthy country, that everyone has an income where they can live with dignity and look after their health, and everyone has access to housing that's genuinely affordable and stable and secure. So we've been around for about 12 years and, have...
Congratulations.
Advocate on both federal and state issues, and obviously were very active during the federal election that's just passed.
Yes, so, and talking about that, that's partly why we've got you on today. You've made some calls, to ask the government to take some action, especially given that they've got this, what's been called a supermajority in the House at the moment. What do you think the government can do now that they have got really no excuses to take action?
Yeah, well, none of these issues are really mysterious when we drill down into them. I mean, people sometimes like to act as if, poverty is this complex phenomenon that, we're going to be stuck with, but any of us who can remember, you know, what happened 5 years ago when COVID hit, and Scott Morrison, of all people, surprised the entire country by overnight doubling the rate of job seeker and lifting hundreds of thousands of people out of poverty, will know full well that actually the solutions are quite clear and straightforward. And we've known for a long time governments can absolutely raise the rates of income support. It's like it's absolutely doable. Like it's happened again, and we know that this is one of many things where in the first term of the Albanese government there was basically no action. People on JobSeeker who were struggling to put food on the table during the Abbott years and the Turnbull years and the Morrison years were still struggling to put food on the table during the Albanese years. So Australia still has one of the lowest unemployment payments in the developed world. And of course, on the housing front, the truth is that we're doing nowhere near the amount of public housing that we actually need to meet community need and population growth. I mean, the Albanese government might talk a lot about its housing package, but the fact is that the Housing Australia Future Fund, its centrepiece, has only built something in the order of 360 homes so far nationally. So in terms of solving the crisis, this is not going to get us to where we need to. And, we actually need a massive action. And it's not now with their huge parliamentary majority and very strong political position, then when?
Just going back, first of all, to the point about raising people out of poverty and how, we've seen that it can be done and we can see that it can be done with, pretty much overnight. One thing that I've found really interesting is that there is so much backlash against raising the Centrelink payments into giving money to the poorest in society. Yet all the research shows that if you really want to boost the economy, that's where you need to be putting money. That even from a really just purely economic raising, the level of GDP point of view, putting money into the hands of the poorest people in the country is the best way to ensure economic growth.
Yeah, because people on low incomes don't, speculate on the stock market or the property market or send their money overseas. They spend their money on consumer goods. Well, actually, a huge chunk of their income is being spent on rent, and that's another matter. I'm sure we'll talk about that.
But yes.
The money they receive is virtually all spent. I mean, it would be a very rare person on a Centrelink payment who was in a comfortable enough position that they could actually save any money. But just on your first point, I'm not sure that's quite true anymore. I mean, I think maybe 10 years ago, it may have been the case, but I think there has been a shift in the community. And when we...
in the community, I think, but maybe not amongst the political community.
No. I mean, I think that's quite right. This is absolutely one of many issues where I think there's a divide between the general public who often get it. So when we talk to people, even if you're not on JobSeeker, you may have a family member or a friend who's been on JobSeeker, or you've been on JobSeeker in the past, and you don't have to talk to them for very long, to know that, if your income is $56 a day, chances are it's going to be a pretty tight situation for you. And if you're renting privately, the bulk of your income is going to go on rent, and everything else is being squeezed. The governments might say that, politically, they can't get away with lifting people out of poverty because there'll be, backlash from the public, or there'll be backlash from the Murdoch media. But of course, I think the other thing to reflect on when we think about the election results is what kind of influence did the did the Murdoch media have on the results? And the answer is probably not that much. I mean, like, Dutton was their candidate, obviously, and it was a pretty decisive defeat for him. So, like, I think we have to, you know, stop acting as if the Murdoch media is this, like, bogeyman that, you know, like, will stop us from doing any of the good things that we want to do. But I don't think it's, you know, I think that's an excuse, and I don't think we should, like, allow Labour governments to get away with saying, oh, sorry, like, our hands are tied. If we, you know, if we do this nice thing for the community, the Murdoch media will destroy us. But I just don't think the media landscape quite works like that anymore.
And let's just be clear, it's not just a nice thing for the community, I don't think. I think it's something that's a good thing for, you know, it's a good thing for Australians. It's something that we should be able to afford if we live in a wealthy country. And it's, I mean, it has so many knock-on effects in terms of the environment, in terms of crime, in terms of just general livability of the country as a whole. So just to push back a little bit there.
Oh, we completely agree. Yeah, I mean, that was just, it is quite early in the morning. I mean, what I would say is that actually, are we all benefit from having a strong safety net? Like, we all want to know that, you know, if push comes to shove and we're out of paid work, that we actually have like a level of income that, you know, would allow us to be able to look after their health. And the answer at the moment is that no. If you lost your job and you went on to Job Seeker, and particularly if you were stuck on the payment long term, it would have massive impacts on, you know, your ability to tweet properly and regularly, to be able to access medical care and medicines to pay your utility bills. I mean, if you were a mortgagee and you ended up on Job Seeker, I have no idea how you could possibly survive. And of course, long term you wouldn't. I mean, we know that, you know, if you had a mortgage and you ended up on Job Seeker, you know, sooner or later it's highly likely, you know, you would have to sell and enter the rental market. So the whole community benefits in having a safety net that protects them. And we know that part of the reason Job Seeker is kept so low is that it does further diminish the bargaining power of workers, because they know that there's no safety net for them. They know that, you know, if they step out of line, you know, if they cause issues at work and they end up unemployed, they will fall into deep poverty and end up on an income that's, you know, $200 a week and below the poverty line. And that's if they even qualify for Job Seeker, of course, because there's a whole bunch of rules around, you know, means testing and liquid assets testing. You know, if you have slightly too much money in the bank, then you won't even get a Job Seeker in the first place.
And even if you do, you've then got to go through all the hoops and bells and whistles to ensure that you keep it. You know, things like mutual obligations, which particularly for remote communities are really difficult to maintain.
Oh, that's right. Of course, these aren't just hoops. These are hoops with razor wire, and we know we've known for a long time that mutual obligation does virtually nothing useful for job seekers who are required to show up to useless activities and useless appointments. Like earlier this year in Senate estimates, the head of the Department of Employment conceded that quite possibly the mutual obligation system may be illegal. This is this was in response to an inquiry regarding 10,000 people who may have had their their payments incorrectly suspended. So this whole system of forcing job seekers to prove that they're worthy by, you know, signing up for courses that, you know, may have nothing to do with, you know, what their interests or skills are by applying for non-existent jobs, massive waste of their time and their energy, quite harmful to them, adds to all of the stress that they're already under. The only people who really benefit from the mutual obligation are the little industry of job agencies that are set up to make huge profits by basically acting as the welfare cops. They do quite well out of mutual obligation, but people who are actually looking for paid work, and of course particularly First Nations people in remote and regional areas, the system that, you know, causes nothing but adds to the huge strain that they're like already under by, you know, being on, you know, such a grossly low income.
I'd love to see some research, because I remember I studied economics a long time ago now, but there was a lot of evidence back in the 90s to suggest that there was a cost, the cost of enforcing means testing, even, never mind something as onerous as mutual obligation, outweighed the cost savings that came from making benefits universal in a lot of instances. And I'd love to see some similar cost-benefit analysis on these onerous arrangements for the so-called mutual obligation regime. We're getting close to the end, and we haven't even started talking about housing yet, so we might have to get you on again. But could you very quickly tell us what you would like to see happen with housing?
Well, I was quite simple, actually. Like, the research tells us that we need 940,000 extra public homes, like, across the country between now and 2041. That comes from your researchers at the University of New South Wales and University of Sydney. Incredible research that has been the pillar of the national Everybody's Home, Housing campaign, which the Anti-Poverty Network supports. So, you know, like, a very good start here would be the government committing to that. And, like, that would mean actually that we don't build a few hundred public homes. That would mean that we build thousands and tens of thousands of public homes. The other thing that government could do very quickly is look, why is it the community's job to subsidise property unlike investors? You know, why are we spending $15 to $20 billion of every year on taxpayer handouts for the landlords via the capital gains and negative gearing and concessions? And we know that these are just fueling the housing bubble. It's massive sums of money that we could spend on public housing and other community needs. This is the perfect time for the Albanese government to wind back these tax breaks for property investors who absolutely don't need them. That would be a popular move, and this really is the perfect time to do both of those things. You know, like, that's actually, you know, build the amount of public housing that we need, which is tens of thousands, not a few hundred, and let's stop giving tax breaks to property investors.
That could easily fund the public housing that we need and the social housing. Of course, in the Victorian context, it would also be good if we weren't demolishing existing public housing that exists.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely, that would certainly help. Fortunately, in South Australia, we have a government that isn't demolishing huge amounts of public housing, but they're not like building much new public housing either. But the situation in Victoria, obviously, are particularly stressful. I've been following that here from Adelaide.
Is there any last thing that you'd like to say, or anywhere that we can direct people? I'll put a link to the Anti-Poverty Network website in the show notes. But is there anything else you'd like to add before we let you go for the day?
Yeah, I would say to all your listeners that the Anti-Poverty Network is part of a national network of grassroots groups that are campaigning on the poverty crisis and the housing crisis, and that while there is, like, you know, we're feeling a mix of obviously like relief at the election results, but also like determination that, like, you know, we're really going to have to keep pushing to get the Albanese government through the kinds of things that we need. But wherever you live in the country, there's likely to be groups like us nearby. And shout out to, you know, Arahu, the Renters and Housing Union, who are very active in Melbourne and do excellent campaigning. The Unemployed Workers Union, I would be very familiar to many of your listeners, the Anti-Poverty Centre. So even if you're not based in Adelaide, you know, if like me, you're furious about what's happened to the housing market, how people on JobSeeker and other selling payments are treated, chances are that there are other activists, you know, I'm not too far from you, who you can connect with.
Great. Thank you very much for your time this morning. I know that you're half an hour ahead of us, or behind us rather, so it's a lot earlier for you than it is for us. So thank you for making the time to speak with us today.
No worries. My pleasure.
That was Pass Forgione, who was talking to us from the Anti-Poverty Network in South Australia. I think that we've probably got time for a song. What do you reckon?
Yes, I can play a song. Oh, you've got one.
I was thinking that we could play Black Nation by Emma Donovan.
Terrific. Let's do that. Sounds good.
Okay. Let's play that. And that was Black Nation by the inimitable Emma Donovan. Let's go to some community announcements. Do you want to start off?
Yeah, absolutely. Just one for the calendar, which is on the 15th of May at Miscellanea. There is a screening of Our Warrior, the story of Uncle Robbie Thorpe. And you can check out future screenings as well and all those details. If you just Google Our Warrior Docker, you'll take you to the website and you'll see that there's a few screenings coming up. They tend to sell out pretty quickly because it's an amazing documentary. And, you know, Uncle Robbie Thorpe is hopefully a familiar person to 3CR listeners, but yeah, as you might be aware, the documentary has been screening for a few months now and is continuing to screen through community screenings. So, and actually, you know, if you are someone who's interested in organizing a community screening, you can do that as well. You can just head to the Our Warrior Docker website and you'll see there's a section there and you can organize a space and you can get the file and projector and all that and set up your own community screening. And you might even be able to get a Q&A going and all those sorts of things. So you can check that out.
And on Saturday, there will be a rally that's being organised by the Tomorrow Movement. Those of you that listened to Tuesday Breakfast yesterday, they were the first item up on that. The blurb says, Labour has a majority government, Liberal vote is at an all-time low. Labour has no excuses to not deliver the transformational changes that we need. The rally starts at Labour headquarters, which is 438 Docklands Drive in Docklands, at 11 o'clock on Saturday. You can go to tomorrowmovement.com to register and find out more information. Then, as usual, there's loads of stuff happening at the Black Spark Cultural Centre. I love the idea of there is a talk on techno-feudalism and the arts called Surfing the Web, with the surfing with an E, hosted by Romeo and Loxy. That's happening on the 12th of May. Well, it starts on the 12th of May, which is next Monday, at 6 p.m. at the Black Spark Cultural Centre. Tonight, there is lessons on Arabic music starting at 7 p.m. And that's with Makam Bayati. So that's happening tonight. And there is a poetry night tomorrow at 7 o'clock, and at 7:30 on Friday there is a comedy show. So there's quite a lot of things happening on Saturday at 5:30. There will be free Kanaki songs and stories. So get down to the Black Spark Cultural Centre for there's things happening every evening.
Many, many things. Also on Saturday, the 12th of May, at Shop Bow and Gok at 387 Victoria Street in Brunswick.
Saturday, 10th of May?
Saturday, 10th of May, yes. I don't know what I said, but yep, 10th of May. There's a fundraiser for Teo's Top Surgery, where there'll be Chilean and Vietnamese street food and live music and art sales. And you can check that one out. And of course, on Sunday, Free Palestine rally and the smoking ceremony at Camp Sovereignty with Uncle Robbie Thorpe and friends.
And that's all we have time for today. I think that we probably don't have time for a show rundown. So thanks to all listeners. And we'll be back again next week.
Have a great day, everyone.
Bye.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.